Same-sex marriage. It's now the law of the land. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you had a great weekend out there. I'm Melissa Ross, and the show is always live at 9. Now, never miss a program. Catch the daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the big SCOTUS decision on same-sex marriage and why local activists say there is still more work to be done. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a provocative exhibit comes to downtown Jacksonville today, protesting conditions at SeaWorld. We'll tell you why, plus Culpepper on a busy weekend in the sports complex. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, reaction continues to pour in after the Supreme Court Friday declared same-sex marriage a constitutional right. LGBT activists around the nation and the world rejoiced at the decision. However, religious conservatives decried the ruling, calling it an example of judicial overreach. Here in Jacksonville, activists supporting the cause of marriage equality say their work on this issue is not yet done. This remains one of only a few major cities in the United States that lacks discrimination protections for LGBT citizens. So, when it comes to same-sex marriage and the city's HRO, or Human Rights Ordinance, where do things go from here? Jacksonville attorney and activist Jimmy Midyet joins us now in studio with his thoughts. Jimmy, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And get on the line now with your thoughts as we discuss the Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage coast to coast. What are your reactions to that? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And we also welcome your comments on Facebook. So this case, which had wound its way through the lower courts for some years, now officially on Friday, all 50 states must recognize same-sex marriages. For you, a local LGBT activist, your thoughts?
I think it's wonderful. This is a landmark decision from the United States Supreme Court that finally affirms what we've known for so long, that marriage is an institution that's open to everyone, including those who are gay and lesbian.
It was a narrow ruling, a 5-4 decision. The four conservative justices who dissented were echoing the words of Florida Family Policy Council President John Stemberger. He issued this statement in the wake of the ruling, calling it the worst possible decision that could have happened. He says the ruling is an example of raw judicial power and arrogance that overturned a democratic process. What's your reaction to those who strongly disagree with the ruling?
Well, I mean, I certainly respect their disagreement, and they have every right to express their disappointment with the court. The court often finds itself the center of controversy with its decisions, and these kinds of comments are expected. The fact is, regarding whether it was the circumvention of the people's will and overturning a democratic process, Justice Kennedy, in the majority opinion, made it very clear that these are fundamental rights that have no place on a ballot to be decided by either referendum or legislatures. These are rights that emanate from the Constitution itself and can't be put to a popular vote.
We want your calls on the Supreme Court landmark ruling on same-sex marriage. We'll go to the phones in just a moment at 549-2937. Now, of course, many states had legalized same-sex marriage before this high court ruling, including Florida. It's interesting to point out that the husband-wife attorney team in Jacksonville of Betsy White and Bill Shefford were leading the charge for gay marriage in Florida. They filed a lawsuit that joined several others here and became the basis for the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals decision to overturn the ban on gay marriage here in Florida. The legal community here in Jacksonville was actually, not many people might realize, instrumental in overturning the state's gay marriage ban.
That's exactly right. I mean, prior to or sort of parallel to this, to the Obergefell case that we're really talking about, there was lots of litigation happening around the country, including here in Florida. And what you're talking about, the case that was over in Tallahassee, the Judge Hinkle, the district court federal judge there, invalidated our unconstitutional Defense of Marriage Act in Florida, and the Proposition 2 or Amendment 2 ban on marriage from 2008. So Florida had lagged behind for quite a while when you look back at the scope of how long same-sex marriage has been, or just we'll just call it marriage, how long marriage has been available to gay and lesbian couples since the end of 2003 in Massachusetts, we really lagged behind. And then we found ourselves sort of in the middle of the pack, and now it's just the way it is.
And we'll go to the phones in just a moment, also your emails and tweets. We want to know what you think about the Supreme Court decision to legalize same-sex marriage, 549-2937. Now, let's talk about what's going on here on the ground in Northeast Florida. In Duval County, Clay County, and Baker County, local courthouses, county courthouses, still won't be available to host marriages. Those are decisions that were made when gay marriage became legal in Florida. Let's talk about Duval County. Clerk of the Courts Ronnie Fussell shut down all courthouse weddings in this county after Florida legalized same-sex marriage, and he's saying as of right now he does not plan to change that decision.
That's right, and in fact, he shut down all marriages for all people a couple days prior to the Florida, the ruling that affected Florida. In anticipation of having marriage equality here, because he says he was concerned that some of his staff would be opposed to participating in marrying and wedding couples of the same sex. Now, I've been told by people that I trust that that Clerk Fussell does not have a discriminatory bone in his body. He was simply trying to do what he thought was the best thing for his staff. I obviously disagree with that decision. And I don't believe we've heard the last of it in terms of litigation. I think that there's probably a challenge out there.
And we haven't heard the last of the outstanding issue in Jacksonville of the human rights ordinance. We are one of the only large cities in the country that has not updated our human rights ordinance to cover the LGBT community from discriminatory actions in jobs, housing, and public accommodations. With the new city council being seated, they were just sworn in the other night. Activists who are pressing the city government on updating the HRO, such as yourself, let me ask you, the community that's pushing on this, where do you plan now to go from here with regard to the HRO? We have a new mayor and a new city council. What's next?
Well, I think it's fair to say that on election night, we were very pleased with the outcome. Many of the candidates who we endorsed were in fact elected, or who we worked to support were elected. And it does give us a sense of hope that we haven't had since August 15th of 2012, when the first attempt was derailed at the city council. So what I think is fair to say is that we will continue this debate in Jacksonville, that this fall we will see a new bill introduced to expand the human rights ordinance to be fully inclusive and include the LGBT community.
Let's go to your calls right now on this historic Supreme Court decision. Where do you stand? 549-2937. Gail in St. Augustine. Hi, Gail. Go ahead.
I'm heterosexual, happily married person for almost 40 years now, and I'm just delighted that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the way it did. I think that there's no problem with people who love each other getting married, and it doesn't any way impact my marriage to my husband, but I don't understand that argument at all, but I'm really pleased that the Supreme Court ruled the way it did in both of the important cases last week, this and also the Obamacare, upholding that as well. So it was a good week, I thought.
That's Gail in St. Augustine. Gail, thanks for the call. And we want to hear from everyone on both sides of this. We'll go right back to the phones at 549-2937. Jimmy Midyet.
Yeah, Gail, I appreciate that. I think that what you've said is essentially what a lot of people believe. Pew and others who track public opinion have been looking at the issue of, I keep wanting to just say marriage equality over the years. And we passed the break-even point about 5 years ago where it was 50-50. And now I think in the most recent polling, it says something like 63% of people in the United States are in favor of this court's decision.
Do you attribute that to more and more folks just coming out?
I do believe that. I think that it's extremely important that people who are LGBT come out to their friends and family and people who are important to them for a number of reasons. But for me, I mean, for my reason to come out is because it's just authentic. authentic. I need to be truthful with the people I love, and the personal is political. And this is, I think, what we are seeing in this country. The rapid advance of rights, of equal rights, is attributable directly to the fact that people have chosen to come out.
What would you say to those who see this as not an advancement of rights, but a trampling on religious liberty?
Well, I as a person of faith myself, I have to respect that people differ in their interpretation of these events. And Justice Kennedy, in the majority opinion, even takes great pains to say that people of faith who come to this issue and feel differently than he and the majority of the court and others do, certainly have the right to do that, and they should continue to express their displeasure and work through the democratic process as they can. But because these are fundamental rights, similar to so many fundamental rights that have been recognized over the last 50 years, it's not up for debate any longer, at least in terms of the law.
And if you're just tuning in, we want your calls right now on the Supreme Court ruling Friday legalizing same-sex marriage. 549-2937. Chip, also in St. Augustine. Hi, Chip. Good morning.
Hey, good morning to you. I'd just like to make a quick observation that they pull this this thing out of the Bible. It's in the Old Testament. It says, you know, it's an abomination and all that stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's in the Old Testament that they just ignore. Like, if you wear two different kinds of fabrics, you should be put to death, we shouldn't eat shellfish. There's probably a dozen different things. In fact, actually, I think it's Martin Sheen on the show that he has. He plays the president, and he does a thing where this lady comes in, and she's a religious fanatic that opposes everything, and he gives a good rundown of the things in the Bible that say that that also should be banned. But anyway, they're picking this one narrow thing and choosing to use that, when in actuality, what that does is mean that all the people who are working for the state and refusing to do the marriage ceremonies are really violating state law. They need to, the Constitution and the law of the land says that if they're not willing to perform their jobs, they need to move on. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
That's Chip in St. Augustine. Thank you, Chip. And it does come down to, quite honestly, when you look at this as a religious question, how literally one might interpret certain passages in the Bible. Jimmy Midyett.
That's right. And Chip, I love that episode of The West Wing. You hit the nail on the head with that. Our Constitution nor our law in this country can make any provision for ecclesiastic courts that interpret religious doctrine in a way that the state can then act on. That would be in complete violation of the separation of church and state, which is a bedrock fundamental reality of our way of life in this country. But I think that what Chip was raising is an interesting point that has to do with what are state actors compelled to do under this law, under this new ruling, versus what churches and ministers are required to do under this new ruling. And I think it's important to point out that the decision in Obergefell, this case we're talking about, has absolutely no bearing on churches or ministers of the gospel. The state cannot compel any church or any minister to perform a wedding, to join a couple in union that they, for whatever reason, don't want to do. So I just want to make that point because I think that I've already begun to hear people concerned about religious liberties, and it's simply the case that even today there are churches that will not join an interracial couple in marriage. And Loving versus Virginia has been the settled law of the land since longer than I've been alive. So,
actually, the year I was born, 1967. So now I know how old you are. How about that? we'll go back to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. Let me ask you, too, whenever something like this happens, of course there will be a pushback. There's a push and pull in this country on major issues. States like Louisiana, Mississippi, some counties in some states saying they're not going to honor the new law. At the same time, you have presidential candidates like Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz, going so far as to call for civil disobedience and even referencing the legacy of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., saying that it's tradition in this country to protest decisions that some Americans might not feel are right or proper. What about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, people have a First Amendment right to free speech. They can protest. They can do whatever they feel is necessary. They can make it a cornerstone of their presidential campaign. But I think because the country itself has moved on, these folks are really showing themselves as being outside of the mainstream at this point.
You think so?
I think so.
Let me ask you, too, Mayor Alvin Brown, who, of course, leaves office in a couple of days, before he was defeated by new Mayor Lenny Curry, he ordered an Office of General Counsel review of all policies in Duval County government to see if there are instances of discrimination against any citizen, not just an LGBT citizen, but any citizen. It's your understanding, Jimmy, that that review is almost ready to be made public. Is that right?
That's right. Well, when Mayor Brown, who we have to thank for his years of service to the city, when Mayor Brown ordered that review, he set a deadline for the general counsel of June 30th to have that comparative report released. And from what I understand, that is on course. So we will know by the end of the day tomorrow where the gaps are in our...
That's coming out tomorrow.
That's today or tomorrow. I mean, tomorrow is the 30th, I think. So that's the deadline.
And yeah. So we'll look for that. But right now, let's go back to your calls at 549-2937. Philip in Fernandina Beach. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, hi. My name's Philip. Good morning. Enjoying your show.
Thanks.
My view on the whole thing is I fully support the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on gay marriage. As far as the religious argument that it goes against your tenets, you know, my whole take on that is, well, then, you know, if it's against your religion to marry someone of the same sex, then don't marry someone of the same sex. But please don't push your views on others. And that's pretty much my take on it.
All righty. Thanks, Philip, for the call. Let's go to Sam in Ponte Vedra now. Hi, Sam. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm curious as to commentary. Now that the Supreme Court has made its ruling and they did away with the argument regarding procreation as being a bedrock of marriage, being between one male, one female, is the next horizon for marriage equality going to be with plural marriages, polygamy marriages?
Thank you for that question. That's Sam in Ponte Vedra. That question has come up quite a bit as this debate has played out over a number of years. What about his question?
That's a legitimate question, but I think the answer though is no, because what we see the Supreme Court doing here is not. I mean, and this is a quibble with terminology, but the Supreme Court didn't redefine marriage. The Supreme Court simply acknowledged that LGBT people have the right to be married. What your question suggests is a complete redefinition of the institution of marriage, one that changes it from a contract and frankly, hopefully, romantic love between two adults to something else. That would be redefining marriage as we know it. And I don't anticipate such an outcome.
What are your final thoughts on this issue?
Well, to me, it's a remarkable time to be alive. I mean, for people like me who grew up without the possibility of marriage, to see our rights opening up, it must be similar to the way that folks felt during the civil rights movement to see Brown versus the Board, that's Lawrence for us. And then to see Loving versus Virginia, which is Obergefell for us. It's really a remarkable time to be alive in LGBT.
Thanks for joining the program.
Always glad to be here.
He is Jacksonville attorney and local activist Jimmy Mediette, and much more still ahead on the show later. Cole Pepper on a busy weekend in the local sports complex. But up next, a provocative exhibit protesting conditions at SeaWorld, why it's coming to downtown Jacksonville today. That's in a moment.
Hi, I'm Rick Mullaney, Director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Join me for WJCT's quarterly program, Policy Matters. On each installment, we look at how public policy affects our lives. Join the conversation as we speak with incoming Jacksonville City Council President Greg Anderson. That's on the next Policy Matters, Tuesday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
New name, new look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Morning keynote speaker, mental health advocate Jessie Close, who wants to change how people talk and think about mental illness. An ambassador for Bring Change to Mind, a not-for-profit organization founded by Jessie's sister, actress Glenn Close. Jessie fights stigma and misunderstandings to create a clearer picture of mental disorders. Good for you. Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
Join us for the radio variety show that celebrates the culture, art, and history of Northeast Florida.
Wake up in the morning, yeah.
Swamp Radio features musicians, poets, playwrights, and interviews that tell the unique story of our home.
My idea was to take them to the epicenter of Southern cooking, the Waffle House.
What you do best is most everything.
Swamp Radio, Saturday night at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, a provocative exhibit is open to the public today in downtown Jacksonville. It's called iOrca, an empathy project activists are taking around the state to raise awareness about what they say is SeaWorld's cruelty to orcas. Now, of course, that's something SeaWorld management disputes strongly. We'll tell you what they have to say in a moment. This exhibit uses wireless Google virtual reality goggles to immerse the participant in a world where they can swim freely in the ocean with their orca family. They will also meet an orca mother, voiced by actress Edie Falco, who mourns the baby stolen from her. Alex Blount is a spokesman with PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and he's on the line now. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this exhibit, iOrca, is coming to the corner of Monroe and Hogan Streets in downtown Jacksonville today at noon. What will people see?
Well, we have a virtual reality experience that we developed to help build empathy for the marine animals at SeaWorld and similarly abusive amusement parks. These animals are kept in tanks that are a tiny fraction of the size of their natural ocean habitat. They've been robbed of everything that is natural to them. And, you know, to an orca, it's the equivalent of being kept in a bathtub for decades on end. So we're just going out in Jacksonville, downtown, and just asking people to leave SeaWorld and other marine mammal parks out of their summer plan.
This is the latest effort in a campaign that's been going on for a number of years to raise awareness about what animal activists say is cruel treatment at SeaWorld. The documentary Blackfish, which came out recently, was another part of this initiative. For those who aren't familiar with this, can you tell us about this campaign? Because it's been going on for some time.
Well, you know, our campaign, so we're asking people to boycott SeaWorld, and why we're doing that is because the artificial environment that SeaWorld provides for these orcas is totally inappropriate and cruel. An orca in the wild would swim up to 100 miles a day, and they would stay with their families for their entire lives. In SeaWorld, they're left to float endlessly in a barren concrete tank in chemically treated water. They are grouped, you know, often incompatibly with other orcas, and they lash out at one another. And they suffer broken teeth and chronic pain from chewing on the gates of their tanks or the tanks themselves. And so we are trying to help the public understand why they shouldn't support SeaWorld.
Now, let me ask you as well about the response from SeaWorld. SeaWorld, in response to your exhibit and the Blackfish film and other things that have happened around this issue, recently published an open letter giving their position on this. And I'm going to quote from it. SeaWorld does not capture killer whales in the wild. Due to the groundbreaking success of our research in marine mammal reproduction, we haven't collected a killer whale from the wild in 35 years. In fact, only two of the whales in our care were collected by SeaWorld, and they continue to be in our care today. In addition, our research has led to a much greater understanding of whales in the wild, giving researchers important scientific insights surrounding marine mammal reproduction. We do not separate killer whale moms and calves. SeaWorld directly disputing what you're saying. What about their open letter?
Well, you know, they are not allowed to take orcas from the wild anymore, and we are thankful for that. But the fact remains that five of the orcas in their care were captured in the wild, and the story of these animals is so tragic. To take such a social animal, an animal so complex and so sensitive that would live with its family in a tightly knit group, and to reduce its life to floating endlessly in a barren concrete tank is cruel. And to address the point about orca reproduction, yes, they have a very aggressive artificial insemination program. That's something that Blackfish speaks about, the fact that I believe it's close to 50% of the orcas held by SeaWorld contain Tilikum, the orca that Blackfish focuses on, contain his genetics. And this is because, yes, they are constantly artificially inseminating orcas to produce more performers. And it's terrible.
We're going to go to your calls now on the new iOrca exhibit coming to downtown Jacksonville at noon today as we speak with PETA's Alex Blount, 549-2937. Lori on the west side. Hi, Lori. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi there. My question is, how is SeaWorld any different from the aquarium in Atlanta? And would you guys want to close that one down too?
Lori, thanks for that. Alex Blount, what about this? What about her comment that there are aquariums all over the country and the world that have marine mammals in captivity?
I think what makes SeaWorld such a horrendous example and makes it similar to things like the circus is the fact that they are forcing these animals to perform. You know, former trainers have spoken out about how food will be withheld to force these orcas to perform. A hungry orca is much, much easier to kind of ply with food, and you're able to get that orca to do what you want. And SeaWorld's own veterinary records show that they've provided the orcas with psychotropic drugs to get these animals into a place where they are willing to and can perform. And that is why we choose to focus on SeaWorld.
Is it your hope that SeaWorld close, or are you advocating that SeaWorld change its practices?
We don't believe that any business should be based upon the exploitation of animals. We urge SeaWorld to move these orcas to coastal sanctuaries where they can live in natural waters, where they can experience so many of the things that are natural to them that have been torn away from them for decades. And so that's what we're asking SeaWorld to do, is to move these orcas to coastal sanctuaries.
So again,
as well as the dolphins in the seals and all the all the intelligent and complex animals that they keep in these artificial conditions.
And again, this iOrca exhibit comes to downtown Jacksonville today at noon. Free exhibit for people to come see, correct?
Yes, absolutely free. They will be able to swim in a 3D virtual ocean as an orca. It's totally immersive. We have combined a small cardboard viewer called Google Cardboard and a smartphone, and it allows them to experience that joy and the freedom that comes when you are a wild orca swimming through the ocean with your family. And then on the flip side, they can experience the despair of having a loved one, you know, torn away from them forever, only to become a tourist attraction.
Alex Blount with PETA on the line. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be back in just a moment. Well, she's the head of a global corporation headquartered right here in Jacksonville. Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record talks with Laura Angelini, the head of Johnson & Johnson Vision Care Vistacon, in today's First Coast Success.
Laura Angelini is the North America president of Johnson & Johnson Vision Care, which Jacksonville area residents probably have known as Vistacon. Her 24-year career with Johnson & Johnson has taken her throughout Europe and Eastern Europe, working in Italy, then Hamburg, Germany, and then Russia. Johnson & Johnson Vision Care is one of Jacksonville's largest employers, and it continues to grow. It's working on its Phase 7 expansion. Laura Angelini, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Well, you've been in the United States for 3 years now, and with Johnson & Johnson Vision Care for 2 years, and in Jacksonville for 9 months. How do you find the business culture in Northeast Florida?
Actually, it's a very interesting question. In fact, when I came to the U.S. 3 years ago and I started to work in New Jersey, and then I was offered the opportunity to move to Jacksonville, Florida, being a native of Italy, very honestly, I didn't know much about Jacksonville. And our idea of Florida is usually all about Miami. So I came here very curious, very open-minded, and really not knowing what to expect. And I found the business environment here very vibrant, very diverse, and really very welcoming. So I'm having a lot of fun and finding a lot of great talent for our company.
Well, Vision Care, of course, is a global company. And what do you see as Jacksonville's role in the worldwide marketplace?
That's a very unique role that the company really plays because, as you said, it's a really global company. And the global headquarters is based here in Jacksonville, Florida. As a matter of fact, AccuView is the number one global contact lens in the world. And AccuView is a global brand. So the globalization of this business really started from Jacksonville, Florida. And this brand name, AccuView, is now known all over the world.
You recently spoke to a group of Jacksonville University students, including your son, who's
yes.
a student there,
yes.
as part of the school's CEO speaker series, and you emphasized that these students will be working in a global marketplace, regardless of where they are based. Do students understand this?
I think they do. Actually, I am very positive and incredibly optimistic about the next generation of leaders that are coming out from colleges and schools right now. It's a very vibrant group of individuals. I think they do understand the challenges and the opportunities of the global world that is going to be much more connected. It's going to require much significant higher degree of agility and flexibility. And I find the students very, very optimistic about the future and very much willing to make an impact and work in a global environment. So I think they know what needs and what is required from them. The how is probably something they will have to learn along the way, as we all did, right?
Well, you've been promoted and relocated within the company around the world. How do you transfer your leadership skills in such diverse circumstances?
I always try to stay myself and to be myself and to remain genuine and authentic. Of course, I mean, there are cultural differences in the markets I've operated. As you said at the very beginning, I'm a native of Italy. But I have worked in Germany and then in Russia and now in the United States. These are very different cultures. You need to adapt. You need to learn about the diversity and really start appreciating the value of the diversity and the richness that it brings to thinking. And frankly, when you do that, it's fun. And it's absolutely fun. And I love it. But I also stay myself. I try to understand and adjust, but never change, because remaining who you are and bringing your value at the table is always very important.
How would you describe your leadership style?
It would be a good question for my team, but I would think that I would probably tell you that I am a pace setter. So I really like to take the best out of people and to help them understand that there's a much better that we can all do collectively if we work together. I'm a believer in teamwork, not in individual contributions. Now, I like to have great contributors in the team, but it is always most important how we perform as a team and how we create diversity in that team so that we can really complement each other. And I'm a visionary leader. I like to believe that we can all work together for a better world and for a better result, and therefore always raising the bar a little bit higher.
Talk about growing up in Italy. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
Oh, that's a funny question. I thought I would probably tell you I would like to be an actress on theater, on stage, and actually even studied to do that and ended up to do be something different in life. But if you would ask this question to my mom, she would probably tell you that she knew I would end up to be more or less doing what I'm doing today. And for two reasons. First of all, I was always having a passion for travel, foreign countries, and in fact, I have a university degree in foreign languages, so my passion for some sort of international environment was there since I was a young kid. And I was always an organizer. So this idea of me directing others or being in a leadership role would certainly not come as a surprise to my mom.
You've done a lot in your career. What advice would you have for business owners and organizational leaders who are operating in rapidly changing industries?
I think globalization is something we all have to take into consideration in our business world, regardless really which type of business you work in or for. There is potentially concept that only if you work for a big multinational company like Johnson & Johnson VisionCare, you're going to be touched by globalization, but it's really not so. Even if you are self-employed and you have your own business, reality is that the world is becoming so small and so well connected that your competitors will be coming from all over the world. So really embracing the power, the value of globalization, understanding global business dynamics and how you're going to compete against this companies that are going to come from all over the world, from China, from Europe, from Russia, from Latin America, from Brazil, from Canada, from other parts of the U.S. That complexity is going to be vital for the success of any business leader in the future.
How does a small business learn this?
Hiring people that have been having the ability and the possibility to work in diverse environments. They bring that agility and that quick learning capacity that is going to make your company fast and flexible. And I think that's the mantra for the future. The winners in business, regardless which business you're going to be, are the companies who can show that agility and adaptability.
Well, Laura Angelini, the head of Johnson & Johnson Vision Care, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you.
And read the partial transcript of Karen's talk with Laura Angelini in today's Daily Record. Riverside Fine Arts and Sports with Cole Pepper up next.
Today's First Coast Success was brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
My fellow Americans, it is I, George W. Bush. As you know, I've been lying low lately, just a man alone with his thought. But I want to encourage all Americans to listen to the Capitol Steps. You might even hear me suggest the GOP's best hope for the White House.
He is ready. He's my brother.
So kick back and listen to the Capitol Steps, 4th of July edition of Politics Takes a Holiday on this public radio station.
Saturday night at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a cultural gem on the First Coast. Riverside Fine Arts is debuting an exciting 2015-16 season. Executive Director Stacey Aubrey is here now with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's explain what Riverside Fine Arts is all about. You're located at the Church of the Good Shepherd on Stockton Street in Riverside, but you also use other venues too.
Yes, that's correct. Our home venue is
at 1100 Stockton Street. The Church of the Good Shepherd is kind enough to let us use their beautiful facility. There are three different venues that we use there. And we also branch out into the community. We like to stay downtown, but we've gone as far as UNF this past year. And this upcoming season, we're actually using two new venues as well.
Very nice. Tell us about some of the artists, because you really do an outstanding job of bringing really cutting-edge talent from all over the world to Jacksonville for these performances.
Yes, that is what we pride ourselves on. We like to call ourselves the Soho of Jacksonville. We offer a very diverse season, so you always get a little taste of something new with our series. And next year, our season opener actually is a group from Brooklyn called Red Bharat. They are a Indian dance band is how I like to describe them. They're a brass band. They play all over the world. The main performers or musicians, I should say, are Indian. And so they use a lot of the traditional Indian themes in their music. But I kind of like to call them a kind of a ska band. And they definitely encourage lots of dancing and movement. We are partnering for the first time with Hemming Park.
Oh.
And so this concert will be in Hemming Park in October, October 3rd. And we are co-presenting this concert. So it's a first concert presented by Hemming Park, which we're all excited about the revitalization of the park there. And it's a first for us also to have an outdoor concert.
So, how exciting.
Yeah, I'm really excited and looking forward to that so that people can dance around. We're going to utilize the cafe. Of course, there'll be beer and wine for sale. It's going to be a whole evening, and we're going to take up most of the park for that.
So that's in October, but there's a full slate of artists coming.
Absolutely. We also have another concert in October with a award-winning folk singer, Anais Mitchell. She is very well known in the community. And now with Joni Mitchell, who's one of her idols, we're really excited to present her at the end of October on October 22nd. And that will be at the Church of the Good Shepherd in the Sanctuary, because what a better place to hear a folk singer and her guitar in a beautiful setting like that.
So go to your website right now, everybody. Go to Stacy's website right now and get your tickets for this exciting season. It's riversidefinearts.org. This kickoff concert in Hemming Park looks to be a great one.
Absolutely. And we are offering a buy one, get one free for a subscription. So for our full season, we have six concerts, but as a subscriber, you do receive a free concert that is not going to be open to the public at the end of the season. It's $200 for 14 tickets. It is a deal. We also have some
classic. What a deal!
I know, it's
what
such a deal! We have some classical music on our series this year as well. We have a bandoneon player and a quartet performing in December. We have a classical quartet from New York in January. And we have the International Guitar Night, which is four classical guitarists all on one stage, all world-renowned guitarists, in February. And our last concert at the Ritz Theater with the Ritz Theater is Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, and she is the Thelonious Monk jazz vocalist.
Nice. Support them. RiversideFineArts.org. She's Executive Director Stacy Aubrey. We're back in a moment with Cole.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through July 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Welcome back, and finally this hour, a big weekend at the sports complex.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper's here now with news about the Armada, the Suns, Sharks, and more. Hey Cole, were you busy all weekend?
You know, it was a busy weekend, and we talked last week at this time about the fact that the Armada, Suns, and Sharks would all be playing roughly at the same time, starting within an hour of one another on Saturday, and we wondered what kind of an impact that would have on attendance and everything else. And apparently the answer is none.
Really?
Because all three on Saturday night drew very well. The Suns drew 7,400, the Sharks over 10,000, and the Armada taking on Boca Juniors from Argentina, the top traditional club from Argentina, 11,315 at Everbank Field.
So nice.
Between those three events going on at the same time, 28,860 people. And while that's not an NFL or college football kind of attendance, the fact that in the middle of summer, when it's 100 degrees, threats of rain, that those three events are going on at the same time, really, I think, says quite a bit about what the sports appetite has become in Jacksonville.
Absolutely.
You know, not just that there are followings for those. Most impressive, perhaps, the Armada, that this game wasn't even on the schedule 3 weeks ago. And so they were able to put it together and draw that kind of number, I think, shows that there are people who are willing and excited to support the teams, and it's not just about a support of a team. It's about wanting to be a part of it. And so for all three, big weekends for the Sharks, Suns, and Armada. And going forward, now you have to ask the question: well, what does this mean in terms of the sports landscape in Jacksonville, particularly with the mayor talking about, you know, one of his, he told you last week on the show that he wanted to bring an NBA team to Jacksonville.
Yes.
I don't think it's going to happen. There's nothing that's clamoring for NBA basketball in Jacksonville right now, except for the mayor, but the sports appetite is there.
There's a fan base out there, and does it speak to Jacksonville just maturing as a city, getting bigger, more cosmopolitan, able to handle this many big teams?
I think that's part of it. You know, it's interesting because of the weather we have here, and because of the time of the year as it falls with the relation to the school calendar, June becomes a month where a lot of people get out of town, as you know. June and August are probably the more popular travel months for people in Jacksonville trying to get to cooler weather, going up to the mountains in North Carolina or visiting Chicago or wherever they want to go. So in a month where people are traveling, where they've made their plans and they're getting out of town, to have this kind of attendance at three events going on simultaneously is really something. And I've heard no reports of any kind of issues logistically in terms of getting people in and out of the sports complex. And at some point, we'll be talking about a story, whenever it happens, about the Armada looking for a permanent home. You know, this may be 2-3 years down the line, but it's going to be interesting to see whether the sports complex becomes part of that equation or whether some other place downtown or within the city or maybe even outside the city limits becomes an issue there.
Sure. And last but not least, you wanted to talk about the Women's World Cup.
Yeah, down to the final four teams, including the U.S., who take on Germany tomorrow. The other semifinal is Wednesday with England versus Japan. It's been 16 years since that famous moment at the Rose Bowl with Brandi Chastain scoring the penalty kick to win the cup, taking her shirt off and swinging it around, the famous picture that made it everywhere. The TV ratings for the Women's World Cup have been enormous. In fact, one of the earlier round matches for the Women's World Cup for the U.S. was the third highest rated event ever on Fox Sports 1, which is a relatively young sports network, but considering the other two were Major League Baseball playoff games, it shows you the kind of attention that the Women's World Cup is getting this time around.
Love to see that.
It's
always
been great.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, some of the stories of some of the women who play on that team are really remarkable, and they've done a great job of telling the stories about what some of them have overcome and the kind of women that they are.
Excellent. He's Cole Pepper. Follow him on Twitter, @ColePepper. Tune in every Monday for his sports updates. Have a great week, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchik. Make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They're now up on iTunes. And next on Diane Rehm, many Americans are celebrating the Supreme Court's landmark decision affirming the rights of same-sex couples to marry. Analysis of the decision, how critics are reacting, and what it means for the nation. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. Rick Mullaney's Policy Matters will take the place of this program tomorrow at 9 a.m., he'll speak with incoming Jacksonville City Council President Greg Anderson. Make sure to tune in for that and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.